Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. I'm Robert Johnson, and as always, I'm here with the charismatic hillbilly stunt driver to my aging, overweight, aviator-wearing, racist Texas sheriff, it's Christopher Webb.
Howdy, Rob. 10-4.
Breaker, breaker.
There's, come in, breaker. There's a big smoky up my something or other, etc. 10-4.
Yes, and that's a not-so-subtle allusion to the movie that we're going to be talking about this evening.
Yes, yes, it was my choice. This was one...
Which means it's going to be shit.
It's going to be shit, yeah, on the web choice ratio. Well, we shouldn't give the game away too soon. It might be good. Never know. It might be good.
You might have to edit that out. Yeah. Spoiler alert.
First thing I want to say is we did choose this film before the lead actor in it died.
True.
Just because we decided to do the Roald Dahl special, we put this on hold. And wouldn't you bloody know it, in between, he shuffled off.
Yeah. Did you have sort of a sense that it was going to happen? Was it sort of a premonition?
Yeah, I am kind of like that. I think we've spoken in the past where I've gone to gigs and then the performers have died like about 2 or 3 years later. I went to see Jeff Buckley and people like that, and they just died straight afterwards. So it happened.
God, you're like a bad luck charm for celebrities.
I'm the grim reaper of stuff. Yeah, I am. If anyone hasn't worked it out, this is a film starring Burt Reynolds.
R.I.P. Burt.
R.I.P. Burt. And I have chosen Smokey and the Bandit.
Burt Reynolds calls himself Bandit One.
Now put the pedal to the metal. I'm 10-10 on the side.
Jerry Reed calls himself Bandit Two.
We're going to really have to cook.
And Jackie Gleason as Sheriff Buford T. Justice calls them a whole lot worse.
I got a barbecue, y'all!
Burt Reynolds, Sally Field, Jerry Reed, and Jackie Gleason in Smokey and the Bandit. Rated PG, and that's a Big Ten for good, buddy.
Yeehaw! Smokey and the Bandit. What a iconic film of my childhood, certainly.
And certainly for me as well. Very, very memorable, because in around about 1981, my dad was very quick off the mark and went out and bought a video recorder.
Ah.
He went out and got the Sony C5 Betamax. The one that had the big...
Oh, beta.
Yeah, the one that had the big lifting eject lid, so it didn't sort of pop out. It lifted up, and he liked that. He thought that was very funny. John Cleese used to advertise that, and he thought it was brilliant, so he went out and bought one.
Yeah, I can see how he got lured into that, yeah. Yep.
And immediately we went straight to Technics, the hi-fi shop in our town, Milford Haven, and joined the video club there. I even remember our membership number,
W27. Jeez.
Yeah, and the first film that we got out was Smokey and the Bandit, and we kept it for about a week because we enjoyed it so much. We just watched it constantly.
Was it due back sort of the next day?
I think they used to be 3 day hire for about £2. But we enjoyed it so much and we just said, oh, can we keep it for a little bit longer? And so Dad allowed us to do it.
You didn't get those annoying phone calls sort of the next day where you've been charged another $7 for taking it back late.
Yeah, I think in those days video rental was so new they hadn't really worked out how to fleece people properly. He just went, oh, that's all right, we'll let you off.
Oh, those halcyon days.
Yeah. Interestingly, the other video that we used to get out there quite regularly was a George Hamilton film.
Which one?
Zorro the Gay Blade.
Oh, I love that film. I think I do anyway, because, God, that's a candidate, actually. Because when I watched that, I was about 10, 11 when I watched that, and I didn't know what the hell I was watching. You know, it was just one of those things where you just sort of flick it on and, oh, yeah, it's about Zorro. Oh, he's got a gay brother.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Exactly the same, because my dad sent me in to get a video, and I would have been about 11, and I thought, well, that's quite a funny title, and it's about Zorro. Yeah. And so I took it to the counter, and it was a AA, which you had to be 14 to get. That was the certificate on it, a AA. Now they've changed it to 15, obviously, so it was a AA. And they were saying, oh, so why are you getting this then? And I said, well, my dad told me to get something that looks good. And they were just like, snigger, oh, let him have it, go on, let him get it out.
Yeah, but like my recollection, which as we have proven throughout this podcast, not always 2020.
Yeah,
I remember really enjoying it. It was kind of like a bit of a surprise. What the hell is this? Actually, it's kind of funny.
We could watch that at a future time. We could add it to the list.
Yeah, you can just see the the brainstorming session. Let's make a Zorro film, but he's gay.
It was the decade of high concept.
It was genius. Yeah, so Smokey and the Bandit. And look, I was pleased, not when you sort of inadvertently through supernatural powers caused Burt Reynolds' death.
Mm.
But I was pleased when you decided to watch this film, because this was one that, when I was a kid, it was on, God, it was on Saturday. They always put it on a Saturday night on TV2 constantly. And I just remember watching this with my dad and my older brother. And it was one that the three of us could all sit down with a cup of tea and really, really enjoy. And I just remember my dad and my brother really loving it. And so, of course, I loved it by, you know, association.
Yep. And, four of us. My mum used to sit and we'd all wet ourselves laughing watching it. So we'd have a great old time every single time that we watched it.
Yeah. So, and I haven't seen it. God, it must have been, I probably haven't seen it since I was about 10. So this was quite quite a trip down memory lane.
I remembered very little of it. I remember the general concept and not understanding the general concept of it at the time. Yeah. I still don't.
Yeah,
I still don't understand bootlegging. So we'll talk about that in a bit as well.
Okay, I might be able to help explain.
Have you done some research about pasteurisation like I have?
Well, I just don't think it was that complicated.
It didn't need to be. To me, it was a bit like not understanding but going along with the ride as well, with things like Midnight Run.
Yeah.
Where I never understood things like bail bonds and stuff like that, but you just go with it.
It's funny you should mention that, because I was reading an article about Midnight Run just the other day, and I was still kind of having to Google bail bondsman and what is a modern day bounty hunter again? And
I've still no idea.
Yeah, because the US is sort of one of the only countries in the world that actually still has bounty hunters.
And Mos Eisley does as well.
Yeah. Midnight Run might be another episode. God, we're doing well. Zorro the Gay Blade, Midnight Run. Oh, but we know Midnight Run's good.
It really is. Yeah,
Midnight Run's an established classic. So,
I never really understood the whole concept, but I do remember there being some good stunts.
Yeah.
I remember thinking that Sheriff Buford T. Justice was the funniest thing on the planet. And so it must still be brilliant.
And I just remember sort of Burt Reynolds being just so cool. You know, I remember his red shirt. I remember, of course, the iconic Trans Am with the black and gold. How cool that was. Just that there was lots of hilarious action and driving and hijinks. And shall we see if our memories have been accurate? Or
let's
or
do
let
that.
Us, let us down once again.
Why not?
So this is what, 1977 this came? Look, I tell you what, I was really surprised that Burt Reynolds' debut was Deliverance. That's kind of what established him, because I thought, I don't know why, Deliverance was like his arty, sort of serious thing that he tried to do a little bit down the track, you know, like he had become famous from Smoking the Bandit and just wanted to do something kind of...
Wanted to take himself seriously.
Yeah, and so he did Deliverance, but no, it was the other way around. He actually started out with a really amazing, serious film and quite a good dramatic role, and ended up doing fluffy shit like this.
Because he did a couple of gritty ones at the beginning. Have you seen Hustle?
No, I haven't seen Hustle.
It's his Dirty Harry.
Oh,
he
okay.
plays he
yep.
plays a gritty
Dirty Bertie.
Sort of city Dirty Bertie.
Yeah.
He plays a gritty, I think it's like an LA or a New York cop, and he's investigating vice and there's an underage girl. So it's very similar to Get Carter, and it's got a really, really bleak and downbeat ending. Not that something you'd expect from a Burt Reynolds film. It's really great. It's a really, really good film. But then right. He grew a moustache. He met Hal Needham, I think, on the set of Gator. And
the man who sort of inadvertently made and destroyed his career.
Together they made beautiful music, because they also made a film called Hooper, which I'm not sure if you've seen.
No, I haven't seen it, but I've read a lot about Hooper.
I've seen that many times. I was going to select it for this podcast as well, but we've done the Reynolds Needham thing now. So Hooper is effectively turned into the Fall Guy on TV. It's the hijinks of a Hollywood stuntman. It's Burt Reynolds and Jan Michael Vincent. And Sally Field, obviously, doing some zany stunts at the end.
Was Hooper the one... Because when I sort of said Hal Needham inadvertently destroyed his career, he was offered the role, the Jack Nicholson role in Terms of Endearment, which, of course, Jack Nicholson went on to win an Oscar for. And I'm not saying Burt Reynolds would have put in an Oscar-worthy performance, but apparently he decided to do Hooper instead of Terms of Endearment because he felt like he felt more of an obligation to Hal Needham than... Is it James Brooks, the director of...
James L. Brooks, yeah.
Yeah, the director of Terms of Endearment. And so he passed on a quality, sort of dramatic role to do another fucking lightweight...
Shit-kicking car chase film.
Shit-kicking car chase film, yeah. Mm. And I mean, by all accounts, Hooper is, you know, enjoyable and was a mild success and everything. But Yeah, there was never going to be Oscar talk.
So I was thinking, because James L. Brooks, he was involved in, what's the other Jack Nicholson film? Is it As Good As It Gets?
Yeah, trying to
picture
gets.
Burt
yeah,
Reynolds
yeah, yeah.
in that. That's how it could have gone.
As a sort of prissy, obsessive compulsive...
yeah, who's hilariously racist and homophobic.
May to December relationship with Helen yeah. Hunt. Could have worked.
I would have seen it. Because I think because of that, Burt Reynolds is often maligned as this guy who only makes bad choices in films. You know, but looking through his back catalogue, there is some quality. I'm not just talking about the resurgence of Boogie Nights, which, of course, was like a rebirth to him. But like those ones, I always forget he was in Deliverance.
And like I said, you know, I just always assumed that was his kind of, oh, I'm going to do something, you know, kind of serious now. And he was really good in Deliverance. He was, it was a supporting role, but... Mm. To an extent, but you know, he was just really credible in it, and to the point where he even insisted on going over the little waterfall or the rapids himself. So John Borman was like, "No, we're gonna do a dummy on the raft," and Burt Reynolds said, "No, look, I want this to look real. I want to do this," and so apparently he did it, broke his tailbone.
Ooh.
He was in hospital, and John Borman went and visited him, and Burt Reynolds said something, you know, how did it look? And John Borman said, like a dummy going over
oh, going over no.
So, you've got to admire the commitment there, and just kind of like the very kind of superficial research I did, it sounded like he actually was a decent actor. He had kind of a decent career trajectory of an actor who started out on the stage and did some TV work and sort of, you know, plotted away and bided his time. And
you forget how successful he actually was.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you do, because you do think of Burt Reynolds, you think of a more lightweight Tom Selleck,
which is pretty flimsy, yeah.
Which is a pretty bloody flimsy. Of course, it really wasn't until Boogie Nights, was it, that he did actually dally with quality again.
That's right. And apparently, I'm not sure how well he could recognise the quality, because he was so embarrassed about being in a film involved with porn. He wanted his name taken off the credits. Until the Oscar nomination, of course.
Well, I'm sorry, but a man who has carved out a career with that moustache cannot throw stones about being associated with porn.
And that cosmopolitan photo spread, let's not forget that.
Exactly. Would anything have been visible, though, through the hair?
Very long moustache. His pant moustache would have covered everything.
And only his lower lip would have been numb. But yes, this was definitely the film that sent him on a trajectory of rubbish driving car chase comedy films.
Just getting by on his smile and that laugh.
Yeah. Getting by on his charm, which, you know, is not inconsiderable, and his charisma.
As Hugh Grant once said, and I'm paraphrasing here, nobody ever lost money by playing who people want you to be.
That's profound and sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's having a little bit of a renaissance too, isn't he?
I love Hugh Grant.
I love Hugh Grant too. We haven't even got to the start of the film yet.
So, Smokey and the Bandit. Before we start, the thing that amazed me, and we did talk about this before we pressed the record button, was in 1977, if Star Wars hadn't have come out, this would have been the highest grossing film worldwide of the year. At $300 million.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I didn't check this, but I'm assuming it wasn't exactly a big budget.
I think it cost $4 million. So not only was it one of the highest grossing ones of the year, it's probably one of the most profitable films of all time as well.
Yeah, it would have to be.
I think that's unbelievable.
It just tapped into some kind of zeitgeist, or some kind of people just wanted hillbilly car chase.
If you were a psychologist or a film historian, you might say it's something to do with the post-Vietnam, post-Watergate feeling, or what else happened in 1977, the Queen's Silver Jubilee. Might have something to do with that, who knows?
It was a strange mustachioed reaction to all those events.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is certainly on the rewatch, even more surprising to hear.
Yeah, that was doubly astounding. Yeah, absolute shocker. But we get the opening credits. I've just written, ooh, trucks.
18-wheeler, big rig.
And then also it's the first of many songs which are just there for exposition.
Pretty much.
All of the songs in this are explaining what's going on at the time. They're very good.
Little old bandit driving around causing trouble.
This film's about the bandit. He drives and stuff.
He wears a red shirt. And
he's got a big mustache.
Yeah, he wears a hat too. I think all of them actually are sung by Jerry Reed, who goes, of course, plays Cletus the Snowman, possibly inspiration for Cletus the Slack-jawed Yokel from The Simpsons.
Yeah. Now, I was about to absolutely hate Jerry Reed in this film because he's really annoying and utterly pointless.
Yeah.
And then I realised that he wrote Guitar Man. Yeah, he recorded it first, and then Elvis covered it.
Did Johnny Cash cover it again?
He may have done. Johnny Cash covered everything. So
he covered everything,
possible,
yeah. Like
yeah.
when he was sort of 75 and covering
yeah.
all sorts of songs.
When he was singing Depeche Mode songs. And that. But it's my favourite Elvis song.
Oh, wow.
I absolutely love it. So now he's fine by me. Yeah, he's great.
You can't hate him now.
No.
And Eastbound and Down, which is the sort of the theme of this movie, is apparently quite a... successful iconic number as well, which I can't say I've ever chucked it on the iPod, but
no, I remembered it when I heard it. It's the whole "we got a long way to go and a short time to get there." I always remember that because again, they're just explaining the plot via the medium of song,
and very sort of Dukes of Hazzard-y, isn't it, Mike?
Incredible.
But so we've got trucks and Jerry Reed warbling away.
Yep, and then we get a very strange opening scene, which has nothing to do. The actors in it aren't involved in the remainder of the film.
No.
So to me, it almost felt like there'd been a test screening, and then, not Bond, there'd been a test screening, and so they thought, well, nobody really understands what it's about.
Yeah.
So we'd better stick another scene just to explain about what bootlegging is once more.
Yeah.
Because it's somebody gets pulled over in a truck, the police open the doors and say, oh, there's some Coors beer in here, this is Texas, so you've been bootlegging and that's against the law. And the driver says, oh, these two brothers or father and son in hats, they dared me to do it for a bet. And that's just there to set up the following scene. I don't think that was in the original director's cut at all.
That would make sense. And even the guy that got to play the truck driver, didn't look like a truck driver.
No.
Wasn't believable to me. He was,
it's like the director's brother or something. They've just brought
he
him
looked like
yeah.
a, he looked like a hippie or something. Yeah. And what has been established is that Truckin' Coors Beer east of Texas is bootlegging.
I tried to look it up.
Yeah.
It's something to do with fermentation.
I don't know why. I don't know why Coors, it's illegal. It just cannot be sold legally east of the Mississippi.
Yeah. Apparently, and this doesn't make a good plot for a film, apparently Coors Beer, as they keep calling it, not just Coors Beer, just in case there's, Coors Cola or something.
Yeah.
Coors Beer is brewed in Colorado or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the brewing process didn't include any additives or preservatives or fermentation. So you could only transport it so far. Therefore, it didn't have a license east of Texas or east of wherever it is that they were going, east of Mississippi. So to transport it across state line is against the law.
Well, Chris, for someone who professed ignorance about what the plot is about, you sound very knowledgeable, I must say.
But it does not make any sense. It's not a good idea for a film.
Well, apparently at the time, Coors Beer was one of the finest beers in the United States. So,
have you ever drunk Coors Beer?
I have, actually, yeah.
Fizzy piss?
I would rather drink Coors Beer, which would be a beer basically brought out by the Coors, the Irish singing group.
You have some of Jim's, yeah?
Yeah. I'll have an Andrea.
Jim provides a frothy head.
So, yeah, it's a strange... I'll admit, it is a kind of a strange plot because it's not a life or death thing, is it? We want 400 cases of beer because we want that beer to drink.
Because it's a bet. We bet you can't do it. That's not... There's no jeopardy. There's no stakes.
Well, trading places... It's kind of like Trading Places. It's a bit.
Trading Places was the other one where I didn't understand, but I went along with it. Because at the end, when they're at the stock exchange, they shout things. And they go, hooray, we've won and you've lost. I have no idea why, but I go along with it.
Yeah, finance stuff. Yeah, after that little sort of exposition-y bit at the start.
But they explain that so many times throughout the film.
Yeah, they do.
They explain it's Coors Beer and it's bootlegging, and therefore it's against the law. They say it so many times as if it's some jeopardy.
This but is Georgia. That's bootlegging.
Yeah. But then it plays no part in the film because that has nothing to do with why he's being pursued.
It's a MacGuffin or a MacDuffin.
Very nice.
Another Simpsons reference. What the hell?
If it had been made 5-10 years earlier, they'd have been transporting, like, drugs. They'd have been transporting marijuana or cocaine. But that's too risky. You can't like somebody who smuggles that. So the very, very light law breaking.
That'd be Easy Rider, and someone would be dead at the end of it, you know?
Exactly, like, yeah. And Jack Nicholson would have played himself, and Burt Reynolds wouldn't have played his part, yeah.
Yeah, it would have just, like, yeah, there's no edge to this at all. There's no,
absolutely not.
There's no darkness at all, except for Burt Reynolds' eyebrows, which are fucking, honestly, they are twice the thickness of his moustache. And they are huge. They've got offshoots that are, like, moustache-sized as well.
Snow on the peaks of them. They're incredible, aren't they?
God. I know grooming wasn't a huge thing back then, but Jesus.
He was a very hairy man. You're absolutely right.
He was hirsute. So then we cut straight to Big Enos and Little Enos Burdett. And Little Enos is played by Paul Williams.
Paul Williams, yes.
Yeah. Who sort of turned up in random roles in the sort of 70s and early 80s in different movies, didn't he?
But while we're talking about the fact that Cleta Snow wrote Guitar Man, yeah. Have you seen what Paul Williams wrote?
In this movie?
No. Have you seen what Paul Williams, the songs that Paul Williams has written?
Oh, he's written multitude of, yeah.
He wrote Rainbow Connection.
Yeah, yeah.
He won an Oscar for A Star Is Born and all this sort of stuff. I had no idea.
Yeah, no, he's amazing. And
he's on a Daft Punk song.
Well, he wrote the soundtrack to Bugsy Malone.
Unbelievable. I didn't know any of this.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't you know he was an actual musician? Yeah,
I thought he was a funny small man.
So you don't remember the episode of the Muppet Show when he appears and he sort of has a duet with Kermit or sings some stuff?
No, none of this. I didn't know any of this stuff about him.
And in The Phantom of the Paradise, that's kind of the whole thing with casting him as Swan, the musical impresario, is because he actually is one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had absolutely no idea. I was so impressed.
You just thought he was a weird sort of blonde, dwarfy Yoda who played creepy, funny small men.
Like a Ronnie Corbett kind of man. That's what I thought he was.
He's sort of like a dark, creepy Ronnie Corbett. Yeah. Oh, wow. I'm amazed that you didn't realise
this. I was blown away. I really was.
Well, it's nice when things like this happen.
That perked me up a bit when I was researching this, actually. It cheered me up some, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. And I have no idea who Big Enos is.
No, I didn't bother looking into him. I was so blown away by Little Enos. If I looked at him, it turned out he'd written the Bible or something.
Yeah, well, Paul Williams was a small man, so I'm sure he did have a Little Enos as well. And they really hastily talk about who Burt Reynolds' character is.
Yeah, it's all shot from behind, so you can't see their lips moving. Again, it's some ADR.
Yeah,
they're driving along and you hear them say, oh, well, the bandit is this man who drives and he's a big show off. And if anyone challenges him, he'll do it. Let's go and challenge him, shall we?
Yeah, he's got this amazing ego. Blah, blah, blah. And he's competing in the Georgia State Truck Rodeo in Atlanta. And they find the bandit relaxing in a
hammock.
It was such a thinly sketched way of establishing the character that I just kind of still felt like he's Burt Reynolds. He's a devil-may-care, charming rogue who is a show-off and can drive really well.
Maybe it was budgetary constraints, but wouldn't it have been better to show him in the truck rodeo, doing some fancy driving and showing off?
Yeah, that would have made more sense.
You don't need the voiceover going, oh, he's a show-off. You show him showing off.
Well, you know, in a movie, it's always better to tell, not show. So
certainly is in this one.
That's exactly what they've done here. They could have established exactly who he is straight away in the rodeo, you know, saying some kind of pithy lines, being reckless, taking risks, doing a slow-mo Dukes of Hazzard jump or whatever. But no, instead he's in a hammock sassing Big Enos and Little Enos.
Yeah, the first thing he does is the traditional Burt Reynolds laugh. He lifts his hat over his eyes, and goes, ha, 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 ha.
And then he says, I didn't know, I like the suits. Must have been hard for anyone in super extra fat and tiny dwarf or something. Which is like, okay, not your best work, but, you know, good, decent burn.
This might be okay, I thought at that point. That's all right.
And pretty quickly, they offer him $80,000. To haul 400 cases of Coors beer from Texarkana, Texas, back to Atlanta in 28 hours.
And that's, of course, then the bandit says, you realise that's bootlegging, don't you? Because it's Coors beer and you can't take it over the state line.
And he proceeds to draw a diagram on a whiteboard. And
there's a graph about fermentation times from Colorado.
Yeah, so just one more time.
Yeah.
Bootlegging is, he accepts the challenge because he's like Marty McFly, you know, he has to accept these sorts of challenges. Yep. He can't be called a...
Nobody calls him a chicken, absolutely.
And you get the feeling that he's kind of just coasting along in this life of his.
Mm.
So he immediately goes and recruits his offsider Cletus the Snowman, played by Jerry Reed, and Cletus's wife isn't happy about this at all, and kids, and Cletus just abandons them effectively for this risky...
He certainly does, he just buggers off.
Illegal venture.
Yep. So Bandit explains the plan to him again.
Yeah. Yep.
And of course, Cletus says, of course, beer, you realise that's bootlegging, don't you?
Yeah. Yep. And Cletus chucks his hound dog, Fred, in the truck. So we should mention as well that the Bandit has acquired two vehicles for this mission.
Yes.
The Bandit 1, which is the big 18-wheeler, and Bandit 2, which is the iconic Pontiac Trans Am. It's widely known that this film, even though Dukes of Hazzard apparently was... there was a Dukes of Hazzard film, apparently, which was very shit. This was the influencer of Dukes of Hazzard. So right down to the slow-mo jumps over washed-out bridges, followed by banjo music, to the whole kind of milieu of southern hillbillies driving away from the law.
Even down to having a lovely Confederate flag on the car.
Oh, yeah, lovely. So charming.
How
so
nice.
It's really aged really well.
Yeah, this was my first instinct of, this is going to be problematic, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, even sort of the characterization, I think, of Boss Hogg.
Who was played by Burt Reynolds in the remake.
Which was an homage. And so, I don't remember this personally, but I did read that in the first season of Dukes of Hazzard, they do refer to Smokey the Bandit quite a bit, or Burt Reynolds quite a bit. So,
I think the other connection between this and the Dukes of Hazzard is probably my first two pre-teen crushes occur in this and Dukes of Hazzard. Which is, I was in love with Sally Field in this. That's my other memory. Absolutely fell in love with Sally Field in this. Probably because she looks like about a 14-year-old girl in it. She still looks like Gidget.
We might want to edit that out.
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
I see where you're coming from.
I'm just kidding.
But of course,
kidding.
Daisy Duke was another one that I was a... She helped me progress into manhood.
Daisy Duke, God, yeah. So, yeah, but Sally Field is very, very charming in this.
Mm.
I was kind of trying to think, who does she sort of... What kind of... you know, vibe am I getting off her? It's almost like a Jennifer Aniston, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like that girl next door, kind of sassy, intelligent.
Yeah, she's not just there as the pretty girl or the damsel in distress.
And, of course, this was... must have been on this film that they met. They started like a 3 or 4 year very serious...
film career.
Well, not just film career, but...
I know, but they were courting, yeah.
They were courting. Mm. One of the things that is quite tangible in this film is the chemistry between Burt Reynolds and Sally Field. I think
most definitely.
You can actually see shots where there's not actually a lot of acting, where she's sort of smirking and smiling, and you actually think, yeah, she's actually digging on this guy.
Because she'd already won an Oscar at that point, I think, for Norma Rae, had she? Or
maybe that might have been early 80s.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Because that was the whole "you really, really like me" speech, wasn't
you
it?
Like
that
was phenomenal. Really like... But yeah, you just kind of get the impression that she, you know, she's no Lonnie Anderson anyway. Put it that way. No disrespect to Lonnie.
Have you said Lonnie Donegan for sure?
I really enjoyed her work in WKRP in Cincinnati. But,
yes, me too.
So anyway, Cletus and the Bandit, they're off on their mission.
Yep, and then then follow some incomprehensible CB bollocks. There's a lot of breaker 10-4 good buddy choke and puke and all this nonsense.
Choke and poke.
Now, was CB radio a big thing in New Zealand? Because on the strength of films like this and Convoy, CB was quite big in Britain. And when you hear British people talking using the CB vernacular, it's terrible. Any sign of Smokies up ahead? Okay, good buddy. It was awful. My cousin Brian had one, and he'd be on there all the time. 1-9 for a 10-36.
Look, I don't know, actually. I don't know, but...
It was huge. I suppose New Zealanders, you pick up a bit of America, you call each other dude and stuff like that, which, of course, we could never do. When you're a British person, call someone else dude, it's awful. So imagine us with a fucking CB.
I am now. It was
great. Remember, they did it on Blue Peter, the kids' TV show, and Simon Groom, who's from Derbyshire, was, "Hello, breaker, Smokies."
Oh, classic.
It was awesome. So there's a lot of that, which I didn't really understand.
God, they should do an English remake of The Dukes of Hazzard.
We were actual dukes. Called the Dukes of Norfolk or something like that.
Be brilliant.
That'd be fantastic. If only we knew a couple of screenwriters, though.
Oh, God. Don't start.
It's a very sore wound, that one, isn't it? And then we get another song about the plot. We get Eastbound and Down.
Yeah, Eastbound and Down. Yeah, yeah. Which, yeah. Bandits are heading eastbound and down.
I'm surprised there isn't a song called Bootleg and Coors Beer is Illegal. Because that's just what we need at this point. Because I'm sure they go over the plot again. They go over the plan once more.
It's all about fermentation.
Because it's made in Colorado.
It can't be transported across the nation. Fermentation. And it's a fairly uneventful trip to Texas. There's one moment where Bandit is driving the blocker, so his job in the car is to divert attention of lawmen from Cletus, who's actually transporting the contraband. Yeah, there's one moment where just to kind of prove Bandit's skills, he evades a state trooper, and when he does it, he then kind of breaks the fourth wall. He does this little kind of smirk to the camera. You almost kind of expect a little ching. Kind of.
I actually really liked that.
Yeah, it's kind of, it was fitting. And
it's fitting with his character, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's such a show-off, he'll even look right down the lens at you, yeah.
Yeah, and there's not many actors who probably could have pulled that off.
No.
You really do need to ooze confident charm and charisma. So of that $300 million box office take, you know, $299,999,000 of it was Burt Reynolds' charm, really, let's face it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other dollar was the driving and the stunts. Yeah, so they get to Texarkana an hour ahead of schedule. Just shows how efficient and good they are.
Yeah, it's going to be so easy. They're just going to get home really easily.
Yeah, there's not going to be any hiccups here. And then straight away at the start of the second leg, they pick up a runaway bride.
Mm.
Or Bandit picks up a runaway bride. And played by, of course, Sally Field. And in about sort of the first 10 seconds of her being in the car, Bandit manages to insult the length of her legs, the size of her calves, and also implies that she's a prostitute.
He fat shames her, doesn't he?
Yeah, he fat shames her, and then he kind of just general misogyny and just negging, basically. He's sort of like hardcore negging. She's going to be putty in my hands after this.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of worked, really, didn't it?
Well, yes, it did.
Mm.
Despite her chutzpah, yes, it worked, yeah.
Yeah. Then, of course, we're immediately introduced to Buford T. Justice.
Mm. Which is a brilliant name.
It is a good name. Without even knowing the character or seeing the character, you can imagine exactly who Buford T. Justice is. It's almost like a Roald Dahl name.
Yeah. He's basically the guy from Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun.
I wrote this down because I wondered if Sheriff J.W. Pepper from Live and Let Die actually was an influence on Smokey in this movie, because obviously in Live and Let Die there is that kind of bumbling lawman car chasey bit, and it's very, very,
it's an influence on similar. The entire film.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
except there's no Swanee whistle in this one, unfortunately. That's the only difference.
And interestingly, another connection to Bond, Burt Reynolds was offered the part of Bond at one point.
Oh.
Cubby Broccoli offered him the part of Bond, and Burt Reynolds wisely said, no, James Bond can't be played by an American. Imagine that if he'd been James Bond.
I'd love to hear him say nasty.
Things are going to get nasty.
Nasty, yeah.
You imagine the furor that there was when Daniel Craig, the blonde, blue-eyed Bond, came on the scene.
Twitter would explode in its own shit, wouldn't it?
Yeah, a mustachioed Bond. Sally Field would have been a Bond girl.
That'd be okay.
Yeah, that would be good, actually. We also find out that Sally Field's character, Carrie, the person that she's left at the altar is Buford T. Justice's son, Junior. Who is kind of a handsome lunk, but just totally dim-witted.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, definite sort of chemistry and sort of witty banter between Field and Reynolds. Not really funny enough to, you know.
No, like you said, there's no zingers. It's not Bogey and Bacall, is it?
No, it's not. It's just kind of, it's the chemistry that's holding it together and kind of making it work. It's not the dialogue.
It's the little looks they're giving each other and the smirks and stuff like that, yeah. Which I imagine weren't scripted.
And of course, other than their 3-4 year relationship, they went on to do Smokey 2
yes.
together. which I think involved transporting a baby elephant.
Yeah, to transporting a baby elephant coast to coast.
So it wasn't bootlegging to transport an elephant coast to coast. There was no...
No, that's calf legging, I think, or something like that, but maybe.
Yeah.
But they really upped the ante, because I think, if I remember rightly, in Smokey and the Bandit Part 2, Carrie jilts Junior at the altar again.
Oh, wow.
She goes okay. back to him. And so to get assistance to catch him this time, Buford T. Justice calls in his two brothers, both played by Jackie Gleason. One is a hilarious Canadian, the other's an hilarious homosexual.
Oh,
called Gaylord.
Oh, I don't remember. Yeah,
you remember this now, don't you?
I remember Gaylord. Yeah.
I think they were characters that Jackie Gleason used to play.
Yeah.
And so he thought, well, I want to do them. But yeah, they pick up Don DeLuise and they transport a pregnant elephant.
Oh, of course they pick up Don DeLuise, don't they? They have to have Don. That's the only thing this movie's lacking, really, is Don DeLuise.
But have you seen, because I know we talked about it previously, have you seen any or heard of any of the other Smokey and the Bandit
spin-offs? The third one. Spin-offs? Yeah, I've seen, well, not the spin-offs, but I've seen the third one.
Part which, three, yeah.
Yeah, which was initially going to be called Smokey is the Bandit.
Yeah.
And then they end up substituting the Bandit, or Burt Reynolds, with Jerry Reed.
Yeah.
Who poses it.
But it's Justice who's given the challenge, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think Burt Reynolds kind of cameos in it.
Turns up at the end, yeah.
Turns up at the end and Justice when he sees Cletus, who's dressed in the Bandit uniform.
Yeah.
He kind of hallucinates that it's Burt Reynolds and has a little imagined
conversation with him or something.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And so.
Because there was also some TV prequels that were made.
Oh, fantastic.
Which I looked into as well. And they've got some really good names, because they're all called Bandit : So they're called... Yep. I think there were four, and they were all made at the same time. And they basically... They're like an hour and a half long each, and they're all like about the young Bandit. God knows who played it, but they were made in like the mid-90s. And they're called Bandit, Beauty and the Bandit. I've got them written down.
Yeah.
Because they are good. Bandit Goes Country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Bandit... I can't even read my own writing. I think it says Bandit's Other Agent... And my favourite one, which is called Bandit, Bandit, Bandit.
So wait, is it Bandit :
Bandit, Bandit? Yeah.
Wow. That's almost like a meta kind of self-referential kind of joke. It's brilliant.
Yeah. So I bet they're brilliant. I bet they're really good.
Oh, they sound great. Who would play a young Bandit, though?
I don't know. In the mid-90s, who would that have been? Richard Dean Anderson or somebody like that?
He would have been too old by the mid-90s.
So it was Burt Reynolds. Oh, no, it's a young Bandit, isn't it?
A young Bandit.
Ooh, good question. I'd say Nicolas Cage again.
He would have been great. Imagine Nicolas Cage doing a Bandit. It would have been great.
It would be great.
So I've written Breaker. Smokey Bear gets a Bandit on the CB. He's driving right up his ass. Bandit's very perturbed as to why a Texas sheriff would be outside of his jurisdiction.
Yes.
Does he evade him? How does he lose him?
He drives fast and the police car ends up in a ditch, which happens about 50 times.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, he decides to start calling Carrie Frog, because she's always hopping around, cute like a frog, and I want to jump you.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stop the car, I want to marry Junior again, yeah.
A fellow CB-er called Silver Tongue Devil.
Oh, God.
Jumps on the CB. And I only noted this because the actor who plays him, Michael McManus, he's one of these guys that was just in every single television show and a few different movies and things. He's just one of those faces that you go, God, I've seen him a million times and things. But I can't remember any particular thing that I've seen him in.
This is a spin-off podcast because this happens every episode, doesn't it? We should have one called, what have I seen him in?
Yeah, who's that guy?
He's in everything, but what is it? Yeah.
Yeah, everything and nothing. And he has actually been pulled over by the coppers and sort of sets them up for a roadblock, doesn't it? The first of about 15 roadblocks.
How many times do they do the roadblock, banjo music, car through the woods, car goes into a ditch at the side of the road, and the policeman goes out and says something like, "Ooh, what happened there?"
And then I've written here the archetypal proto-Dukes of Hazzard jump over a bridge moment, massive big slow-mo jump followed by banjo music over a bridge. Then, of course, one of the Arkansas sheriffs goes into the ditch, and when Justice sees him, because he's black, Justice says, "What the hell is the world coming to?"
Yeah, and we all laugh. This is, of course, minutes after he's said something about Carrie being a dancer, and he blames it on the commie fags, and we all laugh.
And at one point, he also does say that he's going to hang the bandit from the highest tree.
Yes.
A little bit of a lynching kind of reference there.
Yeah, things we used to laugh at, eh?
But because of all these interferences from Smokey, they're losing minutes. They're losing minutes. And Fred needs a hamburger. So, Bandit decides to drop Carrie off at the Choke and Puke.
Which is a restaurant that does buses as well.
Yeah, but a bus stop slash diner. Maybe, I don't know, maybe they do that. He drops her off at the bus stop. Then there's this kind of weird moment where he's like, Frog, you gonna be alright? And she looks at him and, yeah, I'll be alright. And it's kind of like totally unearned moment of
That scene is two acts worry. Too early, isn't it?
Yeah.
That should be at the end where they say goodbye and they don't.
All they've done is give shit to each other for sort of like an hour. Yeah, he looks all... It's not...
He's all dewy-eyed because she's going. Yeah, he's only known her 10 minutes.
It's undeserved.
This is also the point where I notice that Snowman is really annoying.
Yeah,
he is. Because all he does is if anything happens in front of him that he's watching, he just turns to Fred and goes, ha-ha, that was a bit mad, wasn't it, Fred? For every single thing. It's all he does. Oh, it's gone a bit crazy now, Fred, when Bandit's running over a bus queue of people. Oh, Bandit's gone now, Fred. That's all he does.
He's almost like the narrator. But
well, he is in song too, but yeah.
Yeah.
He is the narrator. He's the storyteller.
And then, of course, comically, Justice comes into the diner as well while Bandit's waiting there to get some hamburgers for Fred the dog. One of those amusing conversations that take place where...
It's a bit like Heat. Bandit.
Yeah, a little bit like Heat. Yeah, very much. I totally got a Pacino, De Niro vibe from this scene. It was just...
If Pacino had gone into that coffee shop and gone, I'm in hot pursuit! Some bitch! Would have been great.
And then Bandit sort of realises, okay, I better get out of here. Runs out of the diner. Frog conveniently pulls up just in time in the Trans Am. He jumps in. She realizes Justice is there. They drive off. Bit of physical comedy, but they swap positions. Totally apropos of nothing. A giant concrete pylon thing is being transported across the road.
Oh, and
Justice drives his Pontiac Le Mans right into it and loses the roof of his cruiser. That was just kind of like totally unnecessary. Didn't really lend anything, you know, it wasn't like an organic, he's lost, it's just like, we want to make him fuck up his car.
Yeah, now, oh, absolutely, so. The running joke of bits are falling off the car, but they still keep going. Yeah. The only bit of that I thought was mildly amusing is when the roof's been smashed off and they're driving along, and Junior's just holding onto his father's hat as he's driving along. That really made me laugh, actually.
It's the real dynamic almost of Boss Hogg and Roscoe P. Coltrane sort of dynamic, isn't it? And then we have another Dukes of Hazzard slow-mo jump into a football game, followed by banjo music.
Mm. Apparently, looking at the IMDb trivia about that football game, I don't know if you did the same, he very did nearly kill lots of people during that because...
Oh, wow.
They prepared the scene, and what they didn't realise was the night before, somebody went in and watered the grass. They gave it a good hosing down. That's not a euphemism. No. They actually did. They got the whipped out their giant sprinklers and gave that grass a damn good watering. Which, of course, when they were driving around the next day, made it really slippery.
Yeah.
And as he was skidding around, people literally were running out of the way.
Was it Reynolds driving?
No, it was a stunt man. Yeah. But very nearly killed a few people. We nearly got those kids, didn't we, Fred?
Some bitch. And then we get quite a good little moment where the bandit actually does explain who he is to Carrie. He says, I just go from place to place and do what I do best. What's that? Show off. And it's kind of like, well, that could be on Burt Reynolds' kind of gravestone.
Yeah.
Really, you'd think. And then Smokey and the bandit talk to each other on the CB. And that's when Smokey tells him he's going to hang him.
Yep.
Nice
he talks about lynching and molasses as if it's supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
And then in the next breath, he says to Junior, I'm going to go home and punch your mama in the mouth.
I shouldn't laugh. It's just I'm not laughing at what he said. I'm laughing at the snowballing awfulness of all his dialogue.
We used to find him hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say, as a 10, 11-year-old, sitting there with my mum and dad, who were mid-30s at the time, thought it was wonderful.
Well, social mores do change. We can't be held responsible for the terribly racist, misogynist jokes that we thought
it's political correctness gone mad when we can't laugh at a man punching a woman in the mouth. it's a sorry state of affairs.
I know. But, you know, we were so starved for kind of knowledge and information back then.
Yeah,
and entertainment.
We didn't know it did damage back then. We didn't know it would hurt them. Yeah. Science has moved on so much since then.
We needed a movie that, much like it explains bootlegging, this movie explains what sort of the effects of punching someone in the mouth, you know.
So I suppose we had things like Nil by Mouth that did that for us. That's the Smokey and the Bandit for domestic violence, isn't it?
That was like mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah. So it took that long for us to realise.
This was frowned upon.
Yeah,
so Justice is a really awful, awful person. Then, of course, we hilariously realise that they've both been CBing each other from the same sort of gas station.
Oh, yes. He's coming back to me now, yeah.
Bandit drives off, and then I can't quite remember how, but Smokey sort of ends up driving on top of another...
Well, the car's on a jack, or it's propped up because they're fixing it, so he drives off anyway,
Yeah. And then to sort of cut a long story short, this basically goes on ad infinitum for the next, I think, about 35 minutes of the film.
Only broken up by Snowman going to a bar and getting the shit kicked out of him. Good. I'll teach him.
The bit of conflict, I guess, towards the end, or the sort of third act bit of drama is when the bandit toys with giving up on it. He's going to sort of throw it in.
Yeah, with about a minute to go, he goes, let's just not carry on, eh? But of course that is broken up, even though they've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. And we know this. Bandit says to Carrie, "Oh, should we just stop and have a bit of a walk in the woods for an hour?" Even though they're on a tight schedule.
Yeah, well, you know, you might have wanted to walk in the woods too if she was your passenger.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I would have taken my hat off. I hope he was wearing a hat in inverted commas when they did what they did in the woods.
Hope so too.
Because, yeah, they go for a walk in the woods. We get another song from Jerry Reed as they're walking through the woods, basically saying, "Bandit and Gary are walking through the woods."
Yeah, Bandit's gonna get some now. Me and Fred are in a bush watching on. This is why I do these things. I'm a terrible pervert.
Hey, he's turned her over, Fred. This is gonna get crazy.
Look at it, Fred. He's putting a hat on.
Rib for her pleasure. Wow, Fred.
Things are going to go slow-mo and then some banjo music's going to play.
So, yeah, they bond in the woods. Then Buford has an argument with a state trooper who says, "You can't drive this car." And then Buford basically stands up and bullies a state trooper. So the state trooper goes, "I'm sorry, off you go then." Even though he's got absolutely no jurisdiction.
No jurisdiction, yeah.
This is a point I noticed as well, that I don't know if Jackie Gleason was unavailable in post-production, because there's so much dubbing that's clearly not his voice. Did you notice this?
I did notice a little bit of that, yeah. That wasn't overdubbing swear words.
I don't think it was overdubbing, because some of it was where his head's... He's like looking at Junior and you can't see his face. And he sort of says something like, "What are you talking about?" And it sounds like Ving Rhames. It doesn't sound like him at all. And where he's arresting that guy in the prostitute's caravan, it's clearly not his voice. So I don't know, did he just bugger off and he didn't hang around for ADR? I don't know.
All I know is that Buford Justice, as voiced by Marcellus Wallace, would have been... the Quentin Tarantino remake of this would be good.
The only way you get more comedy racism in is to get Tarantino in to do it, yeah.
John Travolta would play Justice.
He'd get Brad Pitt in to do the Bandit, wouldn't he?
Oh, God, it'd be good. Leonardo DiCaprio would be Snowman.
That would. I'd rather see that than his Charles Manson film, to be fair.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
But of course there is another Charles Manson film that we know about, and one of our friends is in it.
Of course, yeah. Of course, James Trevena Brown, who's playing which Wilson? Dennis?
Dennis Wilson, the drummer.
He's playing Dennis Wilson, the drummer.
Is it called Charlie Boy or something like that?
We should have... If we're going to bring this up, we should have really researched the title.
Yeah, I'll do some hilarious overdubbing of it in someone else's voice. I'll do it in my Ving Rhames voice.
Charlie,
it's called something like that, yeah. But it's the one that's directed by Mary Harron, who did American Psycho, isn't it? Yeah. Matt Smith is playing Charles Manson in it.
Matt Smith is Charles Manson, which is quite inspired.
Yeah. So, James, if you're listening... Hello, we're looking forward to seeing it.
I think you'll be a fine Dennis Wilson. Mm.
So what happens next? There's more. I've just written another police chase and more CB bollocks. That could be any part of the film. I'm sorry. I might have just dropped my pages on the floor and just read anything.
I've kind of... my notes are very scant at this point. It's basically...
So I think they're approaching the home stretch. They've got to bring it back to that rodeo. And there's a big line of truckers with CBs who are kind of blocking the police and getting him through.
Yeah.
And that's where Burt Reynolds just says... There's a woman trucker, and he just says, "Spot those beavers," or something like that. And you just think, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And she's called Little Beaver, the woman who's operating the CB. Mm. And you think, for fuck's sake, this is the level that we're at. And then, does anything else happen? They just get there? The snowman gets pulled over and there's another chase or something? I can't remember now.
They get there, and then doesn't he, at the end, just decide to take the Smokey on another...
They basically get there with about a minute to go, and they say, "Right, we want our 80 grand." And they say, "Double or quits, drive up to Boston and get us some clam chowder in half an hour or something like that. And so Cletus, who's already abandoned his wife and family, just goes, "Oh, yeah, right then. Okay."
Yeah. Cletus, his real love is Fred, let's face it.
Yeah.
Love of his life. Yeah.
Him and Fred, they've been through some difficult times together.
Mm.
And then it just ends. They drive off. They wave to Buford, and he kind of chases them with Junior running after him. The end.
Until next time.
Yeah. Now, I watched the entire end credits because I was under the false assumption that there'd be hilarious outtakes, like they did in Cannonball Run.
That only happened in Hooper. So Hooper started the hilarious outtake.
Oh, right. Because I know they do it in Smokey and the Bandit Ride Again, or Part 2, as it's also called.
So apparently Hooper was the first movie that introduced the hilarious outtakes.
Okay.
And over the credits.
Because obviously they did him in Cannonball Run as well.
Which is, Hal Needham did that as well, right?
Yes, he did, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so Needham obviously thought, hey, this worked well. People talked about these hilarious outtakes.
Yeah, well, Pixar loved it. They do that a lot.
So again, another hugely influential...
This film has influenced so many genres.
It has. So, Smokey and the Bandit, Chris.
Yeah, that was that.
Still any good?
No. No, it was awful. I really struggled getting through it.
I struggled a bit. I do see why, as a sort of a kid in the 80s, that only was exposed to two channels and very limited VHS. I do see why I found it entertaining, and probably just like the atmosphere of my dad and my brother cracking up and finding it cool as well.
Oh, totally. I'm exactly the same. I would have loved it at the time, and there was light, non-offensive bad language, which was a bit risque when you were about 10 or 11.
Yeah. He said, "Some bitch."
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, there's a bit where he says, "Fuck off," but they do a meh, meh. It's stuff like that. You think, oh, it's great. It's so risque.
Yeah.
But hasn't aged well for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
Not just of the fact that political and social sentiment has changed since then, and you can't openly punch down and laugh as much as you can as you were able to then, or you were permitted to then. It's just the fact that it's totally plotless. It's not exciting.
It's plotless.
It's meaningless.
And when you consider sort of like Blazing Saddles came out, what, 3 years before this or 2 years before this? And just satirizes those attitudes so well.
Beautifully, yeah.
This feels a decade too late, kind of already. Yeah, no, it was a struggle. Coasts along on the undeniable charm of Burt Reynolds.
Hmm. It may as well have just been called Burt Reynolds and we just watch him drive around for an hour and a half. That would have been much more entertaining.
Yeah. Going.
That would have been less annoying than Snow going, "Whoa, we're driving a truck down the road, Fred."
And it's funny watching it again and just seeing even how unexciting all the car action is. I thought, okay, look, at the very least, this will have some pretty impressive driving and stunts and things. And even those are pretty lackluster, I thought.
Of course, we have been spoiled since then with some very, very good car action. But I thought this would have been the one that almost set the trend for very, very popular car chase and car stunt movies. But it just pales in comparison to anything else.
Yeah.
How did you enjoy it?
I really struggled with it. Like I said, I could see how it would have been a fun thing to watch in my ignorant childhood, but it was there's just nothing. There were no laugh out loud moments. There's no, the comedy was really weak. It was almost like watching a foreign film in terms of how alien it felt to me. Like the attitudes and the even the dialogue. I couldn't even just the f- fucking hillbilly gibberish, you know?
Like the hillbilly gibberish, the CB bollocks.
So, yeah, other than, you know, the chemistry between Sally Field and Burt Reynolds and the charisma of Burt Reynolds, it was shit.
Very poor.
Very journeyman kind of directing, you know? I mean, you couldn't... Yeah.
Because he was a stuntman, wasn't he, Hal Needham, I think. He started out as a stuntman and then became a stunt coordinator. And then moved on to directing. His first film might have been like Gator or Stroker Ace that he did with Burt Reynolds.
Stroker Ace.
They didn't test overseas audiences for that one, did they?
So not good.
No, not good.
We've decided not good. With the caveat of acknowledging its massive influence on some things.
On other stuff. Other things as well.
Yeah, it had quite a legacy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
what's next?
So next, Chris, and this was a tradition that we started last year in our first year, we're going to be looking at a Halloween double bill, aren't we?
We are. It's very exciting. I do enjoy a double bill.
I love a double bill. So we each had a choice of a spooky film from our past. Mm-hmm. And Chris, what was yours?
Well, also in tradition at Halloween double bill, I've gone for another Stephen King screenplay. We were so thrilled with the last screenplay that he delivered to us, which was Pet Sematary. I've taken it right back to the start, his first ever screenplay, and that's Creepshow.
Creepshow. Now, I only have the most vaguest memories of seeing this, so I'm looking forward to this.
This was another early Betamax that we used to get out of the shop quite a lot. Myself and my cousin Ian, who's a big Stephen King fan as well. Hello, Ian, if you're listening. Big Stephen King fan too. So we used to watch this and enjoy this quite a lot.
But excellent.
I haven't seen it, literally haven't seen it since then. So I probably haven't seen it since I was about 13 years old.
Wow, okay. Oh, this will be quite the experience for us.
Fascinating, yeah. What about you? What are you going to give us, Rob?
I'm going to give us a film which I've only seen a couple of times, but I remember watching it when I was about 10 or 11. My brother had recorded it. It was a Friday night horror. He had recorded it and was watching it on a Saturday morning, and I just sort of came in and was like, oh, what are you watching? Mm. At the time, being quite captivated by it.
Okay.
I feel like, once again, my memories are going to betray me. So I'm watching, I think technically considered the debut film of James Cameron.
Not The Terminator.
No, not The Terminator.
Oh.
It's Piranha 2, the sequel to Piranha.
So you couldn't have just chosen Piranha.
No, because I actually think Piranha's kind of acknowledged as a pretty good film.
Yeah, and we've done some Joe Dante already, haven't we?
We've done some Joe Dante, and I only watched Piranha, the first one, about 5 or 10 years ago and still thought it was kind of good.
Okay.
Yeah, this one, Piranha 2, I think it's The Flying Killers.
Yeah, depending on where you come from, it's either called The Flying Killers or The Spawning. I think The Spawning was the American title. The Flying Killers.
I watched it as certain
parts
killers.
Of Europe. Okay.
So, and I believe in this one, the mutated piranha have been given the skills or the attributes
the skill,
of flying.
The knowledge of flight.
So flying fish learn how to fly. It's not
you've got to have a certain number of hours in the air, and then you're given your license as a flying fish.
So, yes, so the piranha go through flight school.
That'd be the prequel. Flight Academy.
And learn how to fly.
Excellent. I've never seen it.
Wow.
So I shall look forward to it hugely.
Apparently James Cameron has kind of disowned it, or sort of said he got sacked. Okay. Halfway through, and so that doesn't bode well.
No, no. I'd have said that about Avatar if I was James Cameron, because that's a huge pile of wank.
But... Oh, you're not looking forward to the 12 sequels that are coming up?
Oh, I'll be front of the line to get tickets for those.
So, we'll be hopefully recording that in the next couple of weeks.
Yes, the 14th of October now, so we'd better get a wriggle on if you want them out by the 31st.
Better get a wriggle on, and just like to say, it's my brother's, my older brother Bevan's 45th birthday in 2 days.
Wow, happy birthday, Bevan.
Happy birthday, Bevan.
That's good. It's my wedding anniversary next week.
Oh.
15 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I think we're going to go and see Halloween.
Oh, you're going to go see the
We're going to see the new one, yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Well, I've read pretty good reviews of that.
Me too, yeah. Normally I'd get you in because you used to be our regular babysitter, but it's probably a bit too far for you to travel now, isn't it? A
little bit difficult.
The offer's there if you want to.
Oh, well, thank you, but I'll probably pass just for logistical reasons. But
I'll put a box of Coke Zero in the fridge.
Ooh.
I know how much you like it.
You know how to entice me. All right.
Yeah, let's wrap it up, shall we? We'll do the usual gump. So if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do. We're at StillAnyGoodPod.
Same on Instagram, at StillAnyGood.
We're also on Facebook, Still Any Good, and you could email us if you wanted to, stillanygood@gmail.com.
And we're, of course, on iTunes and Spotify.
Yes, so please rate and review us to allow other people to find us and enjoy this amazing quality that we deliver every single time.
I agree.
Yeah. And, of course, if you'd like to support this free output, Ko-fi with a K or Ko-fi.com/stillanygood, you could buy us a coffee. That would be nice.
That would be lovely. Oh, well, Chris, lovely to see you in your dark garage once more.
My garage is actually quite warm. It's been a very nice day here, so it's quite a warm garage at the moment. I'm not wearing my traditional beanie anymore. You can tell summer's coming.
No, you're not. And they've let you out of the garage a couple of times since we last talked.
Yeah, just to use the toilet occasionally. That's been quite nice.
That's good. All right, then. Well, thank you, listeners. See you next time.
Thanks a lot. Bye.